Hi. This is Practice in Place, Law and Justice Go Viral, a podcast that asks the question, how does a profession governed by precedent respond to the unprecedented? Practice in Place investigates how the practice of law and the administration of justice have adapted under the abrupt constraints of the COVID-19 era, how that has affected how and whether we achieve justice, and how those changes and that experience might or should change the practice, the profession, and its procedures forever. I'm Susie Solman, clinical professor of law and director of the legal writing program at the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law. I'll be your host. When we conceived the idea for this podcast, I had a few hypotheses about what we'd learn when we compared how different courts and different types of law practice responded to the constraints of pandemic life. Now, in most ways, we expected appellate practitioners to have the easiest transition to the work-at-home virtual environment. In-person activity just isn't as important to appellate practice as it is to trial practice. Appellate courts primarily decide pure issues of law. Appellate judges don't need to evaluate body language or other indications of witness credibility. They don't need to account for thorny constitutional issues like the right of a defendant to confront the witnesses against him. Even in, quote, normal times, most appellate matters are decided on the written briefs without oral argument. In fact, in the federal system, over 80% of appeals are resolved without an attorney ever setting foot in an appellate courtroom. And now, with the pandemic causing many states to toll various time limits, including the deadlines for filing notices of appeal, perhaps the overall volume of appellate work would shrink dramatically. In this episode, we test those hypotheses in a conversation with two of the country's prominent appellate practitioners and two of the leading voices on hashtag appellate Twitter, Sean Murata and Rafi Mulconian. Hashtag appellate Twitter is sort of the antidote to the lonely life of the appellate practitioner, holed up alone behind closed doors for hours on end, researching, drafting, revising, and polishing thousands of pages of text. Part crowdsourced answer bank, part virtual watering hole, hashtag appellate Twitter is an online community of appellate lawyers sharing war stories, commiserating over oral argument snafus, mentoring and supporting one another, and building enduring friendships. And it all started in June 2016 with a tweet from Rafi Mulconian. Rafi started his career at Cravath, Swain & Moore in New York City, actually as a mergers and acquisitions associate, before he discovered his true calling in litigation, and specifically appellate practice. He's clerked for the Delaware Court of Chancery and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and he is now a partner in the firm of Wright, Close & Barger in Houston, Texas. He has argued before the Supreme Court of the United States, and he maintains an active practice before that court. He also has years of experience handling complex litigation at the trial and appellate level before courts nationwide. Sean Murata is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Hogan Lovells. He has argued over 20 appeals in state and federal courts, and he has briefed cases in the Supreme Court of the United States, as well as appellate courts across the country. My colleague, Professor Tessa Dysart, edits the Appellate Advocacy blog, which you can find at lawprofessors.typepad.com/appellate_advocacy. Tessa had the opportunity to chat with Sean and Rafi recently about how the COVID-19 shutdowns have affected their practices. They also provided insights into how they see this crisis changing the profession permanently. And they discuss strategies for coping and staying sane in this new involuntary work-from-home environment, from pandemic playsets to radically modified working hours. First, Tessa asks Sean and Rafi how they've responded to some of the anticipated and unanticipated challenges of appellate practice from home in the current environment. Here's Rafi.
Well, you can see from my background that I'm sitting in the Great Hall of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the reason for that is that I'm in a extremely messy office in reality that I share with my wife, who's also working at home. So that's one interesting challenge. We have a 7-year-old who's very boisterous and, you know, likes to hang out with us. And I mean, I think I anticipated those problems, but they're probably more difficult than I thought. And so I've been trying to fix that by working, fairly early and then taking most of the day off, frankly, except for calls and things like that. And then working really late at night and trying to catch up on my hours and my work that way. That is not ideal by any stretch of imagination. I hate working at night. It's one of the reasons I was bad at M&A work. So it's not great, but it's, I think, what we have to do right now. I don't really see any other way to handle it.
Sean?
Yeah, I mean, I think the struggle, particularly with appellate work, is that, you know, the thing I like about appeals work is that it is really focusing on the one thing for several hours at a time, be it reading a case or trying to write. And that sort of requires you to get into a groove or to a flow. And to do that when, you know, two little human beings would like to talk to daddy or have daddy come play with the cars or go outside, or, you know, it's been really, really tough to find time to sit down and write. Now, it helps that I'm a partner now and I have more of an editing and supervision role, but there are still times where, you know, I filed the Supreme Court merits reply brief. And one of the things I do is I print out the brief and I put it on my desk and I read it line by line and edit it that way. And I had to do that after they go down, because you can't do that with other people up. And, you know, I've also been in the usual position that in the normal before pandemic times, you know, I'm a big firm partner. My wife is a government relations associate, which is a fancy way of saying a lobbyist at another big law firm. And she tended to have sort of the better hours and the more lifestyle, whereas I had the more unpredictable time. But given all of the pandemic relief going on right now, it's been just a crazy time to be a lobbyist. So we've had to, I think, adjust to a new normal where I take on a lot more parenting duties because she's on calls and having to get things out to clients, whereas that used to be sort of my thing. So it's been particularly difficult. And also, my kids are 18 months and 3 years, so they don't understand daddy's on a call, and they don't even really understand what's happening. So that's also a challenge. But I mean, the lucky thing, at least for my practice, is that I've got a laptop. I can pretty much do everything I do at the office.
Yes, that is true. And we bought a commercial grade printer, which makes things a little bit nicer too.
A wide array of circumstances created by the pandemic have indeed decreased the volume of appellate litigation, or at least changed the nature and focus of appellate practice. And that's probably for the best for the well-being of the homebound appellate practitioner.
I think that you're seeing a lot of people hitting pause on appellate litigation right now because for a couple different reasons. One is, of course, as offices have to move virtual, everyone has asked for an extension on practically everything. And that's me, that's my adversaries. And of course, you grant them without thinking because, one, you do that during normal times and you do it especially so. I had one adversary ask for a 30-day extension because he literally contracted COVID-19. And I think that's probably the fastest I've ever, you know, agreed to an extension. But also you see from the client side that as they are managing cash flows, they're looking to push deadlines into the future so that they can be in a better cash position really in sort of the next quarter or maybe the quarter after. And so some of the requests for extensions I've been making aren't so much that I don't have the time, but clients that prefer pushing their litigation dates into the future. And so that's been a challenge as well. At the same time, if I had the full docket that I had when we were in the office, I don't know how I would have done it. So in some ways, it's been helpful to see clients want to push deadlines. And at least on the litigation side, the hope is it's a pause, not a disappearance of work. So we'll see how that goes.
Rafi?
Yeah, my answer actually differs a little from Sean's in the sense that my clients are not pushing the appellate deadlines quite as much out because I probably have a very different client base than Sean does. But where we have a big slowdown, and it's just necessarily true, is that a lot of my work is what we call trial monitoring. So where I show up at trial and I sit there and preserve error and, you know, do the legal motions and argue things, argue the jury charge. Well, there are no trials going on in Texas right now. And so there are no trials to monitor at. And that is a big change to our practice. You know, usually of our maybe 15 appellate partners, 8 are out of the office at trial. And right now, obviously, we're all sitting at home. So that's a big difference. And I think our view right now is that when jury trials come back online, there's just going to be a crazy rush of people pushing trial from the plaintiff side. So we think, like Sean, that it's a pause, it'll pick back up. But you never know. I mean, maybe people will just decide to settle these cases because they need money and, you know, they'll go away. So I'm not sure how that's going to roll out. But I agree with Sean that if I had everything I normally do, this would be really difficult. I would say I'm probably at 75% of my normal sort of capacity. And I just don't see how I could do more than that.
Yeah. Have you had any video or telephonic hearings or oral arguments since the courts have shut down?
I've had 2 arguments canceled and have not yet had an oral argument by video or telephone. My partner, Tom Wright, argued in front of the Texas Supreme Court 2 weeks ago, which was the first Texas Supreme Court Zoom argument. And I mean, I helped him in the moot. I watched the argument. I thought it went great. Like I didn't see that was a big problem. Obviously you'd rather be there and there's a certain solemnity and stuff to being up in court, but I think it's a really, perfectly valid way to get things done while we're sitting at home.
Now, Sean, I know you had a big argument canceled. Have you had any arguments via Zoom or telephone?
So, yeah, I was supposed to be arguing in the U.S. Supreme Court this last Monday, April 27th, which was obviously canceled. And one of my case wasn't chosen as one of the ones that would be argued during the May telephonic sitting that the court has added on beginning next week, which is probably correct. All cases that reach the Supreme Court are important, but some are more important than others. And certainly my cases will keep. And I think selfishly so, I hope that perhaps I'd get to go up to the podium in October. But I haven't had any particular arguments because if you think of appellate law as going through cycles of briefing a bunch of cases and arguing a bunch of cases, I tended to be on the briefing a bunch of cases side of it. But I've had a colleague argue telephonically in the DC circuit, my partner, Kate Stetson, who celebrated her 100th appellate oral argument on the phone. And I've also had a colleague argue telephonically at the Third Circuit. So, the biggest problem are people talking over each other, and there's ways to solve that by either calling in judges in turn. But certainly at this courts that I think have done it by telephone and that sort of keep the free-for-all format, you do end up with the problem where everyone will be silent and then everybody will talk over each other, which is the same thing that often happens on regular conference calls. But I think people are more understanding, and I think probably you get a few less questions as people try not to step on the advocates.
Yeah. Have you all had any changes in filing briefs? So I know a lot of courts still require paper copies. Are they still asking for those? And how has that changed?
The vast majority of courts, I think, have suspended their paper copy requirements for the time being, certainly at the Circuit Court of Appeals, which is helpful because, I mean, my finding folks at the office will do it if I need them to, but it's very much a skeleton staff. And I think certainly for people who don't have an in-house binding staff, like say a galactic law firm like mine does, it's gonna be hard to get out and do that. But the Supreme Court for merits cases, for instance, has left its paper copy requirement in place. So, you know, we have a printer, a commercial printer that handles that, and they handled it just fine on this last Wednesday when I filed a brief there. But even for the petition stage documents at the Supreme Court, they've suspended the booklet filing requirement. So it's, I guess, a way to make it easier on practitioners and to, I think it's a safety issue as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's Sean's got it right. The one interesting twist I can add to that is that the Texas courts and the Supreme Court were already paperless, which honestly, it totally shocked me when I moved here from New York. I was, in New York, the appellate courts until recently required you to use a commercial printer. So when I got down here, I went looking for the commercial printer and, you know, promptly laughed at by everybody. So it's been only electronic filing here for many years. So there's no change there. The Fifth Circuit has suspended its paper copy requirement. So we're just not doing any of it.
Yeah, the Arizona Court of Appeals Division 2, which is the one located in Tucson, is one of the most paperless courts in the country. And I think courts that are paperless are doing much better during this time than ones that aren't. And my husband practices in Superior Court, which is not paperless, and it has caused, you know, more issues. How about any war stories about either the changes or your extra co-workers?
Oh, well, so I've got two I can share, I guess. They're both about my seven-year-old, who, first, he knows how to use word processors now, which is a problem. So he delights in adding words to some of my briefs every so often. So when I sit back down after having been away, I need to reread where the page was left off at, because there might be something I don't want the court to see in there. Also, for some reason, he's decided he likes reading the briefs, and he reads them incorrectly on purpose. I don't know what kind of game this is. It doesn't seem very fun to me, but he thinks it's hilarious. So we've been doing that for like literally an hour a day, just reading daddy's appellate briefs incorrectly. I'll take it.
You do like a dollar a typo, you know, for every typo he finds, he can earn some money.
Is that the going rate for typos? That seems high.
But maybe if you're seven, I don't know, maybe it's a quarter a typo when you're seven.
There you go.
Sean?
I mean, I'll do one serious one, which is that I was incredibly proud that my team, drafted, edited, and filed the Supreme Court merits reply brief, literally all of us remotely. And, you know, the 30 days you get for a Supreme Court reply brief only in 6,000 words is really tough, you know, when you're at the office. But, you know, we were doing Zooms where we were putting the brief up on the screen and editing it and talking it through. And so I was, you know, really just tremendously overwhelmed that my team did such a great job under really difficult circumstances. My other pandemic war story is that we've been in a house with a yard for about 1 year now. And when we moved in, we looked at the backyard and said, you know, we should get the kids a playground someday, maybe when they're older. 1 week into quarantine, we bought the playground and had it installed because there was no other way we were going to get through this without letting them burn some energy on some slides and some swings. So that has been good.
Even leaving aside the logistics of work from home, remote appellate practice, the pandemic requires all of us to manage new anxieties, fears, and feelings of diminished well-being. From the top echelons of big firm practice to the second semester 1L, our individual circumstances may be different. But everyone has days when we're struggling just to keep it together, much less adapt to a rapidly evolving practice environment.
One thing I wanted to say is, and I don't know if this is a tip so much as just a fact, which is it's okay not to be okay, because I don't think I'm okay right now, or, you know, I'm sort of getting it through it day by day. But I think as attorneys and, you know, for me as a big law attorney, we're used to projecting a lot of strength and calm and, you know, almost sort of, you know, swapping war stories of how bad it is. But I think this is something in addition and on top of, and it's, if you're feeling like you're just getting through each day, you're with a lot of good company and it's okay to feel that way. You know, I've cried, I've yelled, I've, you know, been stressed out because I have something that really needs to get out that is important and yet cannot get the people in my life to sort of make that happen. And just the fact that it's okay if you don't feel with it because you're with a lot of good company and you don't have to, you're allowed to say that out loud, which I think is really important.
Yeah, let me jump in on that too. That Sean's absolutely right. Like this, one thing my wife and I sometimes say to each other during this is, this is really hard. And just actually enunciating that seems to make a difference to us because it really is hard. Even though we're in great situations, like we're, you know, lawyers who have kept our jobs and things are okay for now. And, you know, Sean and I are lawyers. My wife is not, but anyway, she also has her job. But, you know, in a lot of material ways, things are great, but it's still a really difficult time, and it makes it hard for professional life too. And I think it's really important to recognize that so that people maybe a little further down the totem pole will feel comfortable saying that too.
What do you think the future is going to look like for both for the appellate practice in terms of going back to in-person arguments and just for the legal practice in general? You know, Rafi, do you want to start?
Oh, sure. With it? I mean, I think eventually we'll get back to something that looks like what we had before. You know, at some point there's going to be a vaccine or a solution to the virus, and that will, I think, bring things back. I do have a few things that I think will be quite different in my life, in my practice going forward. And one, and I've said this on Twitter, and I think some other people echoed it, I don't think I'll be doing as much business travel in the next few years. I haven't missed it. I think it's been mostly not worth very much now that I look at it in retrospect. And a lot of what I was doing, I think, can be done on Zoom or some other distance method. And so I think I'm just going to like stop, or at least not entirely, but quite substantially. So that's one big difference. The other thing is, you know, and I'm not probably senior enough to really be in on these conversations, but I think people in charge of law firms and other legal providers are going to have to think about things like office space. Like, I'm not sure that we need quite as much offices as we thought we needed. Now, working at home isn't ideal, but at some point the children are going to go back to school and like this will be easier. And I think a lot can be done at home that perhaps we thought couldn't be done. So I think that'll be a big change as people start redoing leases and like figuring out where to work and stuff like that. It wouldn't surprise me if we ended up with smaller law firms and smaller offices and things like that. So that's two things I've been thinking about. There's one like Texas specific thing, and I think it may be true of other states that I wanted to raise, which is in Texas, you have to go for a hearing for almost everything. So like if you want entry of judgment, even though everyone knows that's what the judgment's going to be, you have to show up and you get up in front of the judge and say, Your Honor, we don't, you know, object to the form of the judgment. There is absolutely no reason why that has to happen in person anymore. You know, that costs my client thousands of dollars for me to fly out to wherever the trial was and see the judge. And then, so if you just like didn't do that, did that on video, you could save a ton of money. And that's even true. That's more true, you know, for family court, for other kinds of court where there's tons of hearings that don't necessarily need to be in person. So I could see a huge change along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree. I think travel's not coming back for a very long time. You know, it used to be you'd just sort of fly out to a client to see them and maybe take them out to dinner. And, you know, you thought the in-person touch was really important. And I think you're going to see a decline of that, you know, as law firms tighten their belts. And as I think one thing that's been surprising actually is how good the video part of this has been. You know, I've talked to people, it's like, imagine this happened even 10 years ago, where, you know, maybe video conferencing was something that you could do at the office in a special room for it, as opposed to all of us on our phones and our laptops. I think that, you know, in some ways, had this happened before, it's just everything would have shut down, honestly, because you just couldn't do it. Now you can. I think you're going to see a lot more willingness of appellate courts to entertain remote oral argument for either judges or litigants or counsel who either can't or maybe for a case that's just not worth flying somebody out somewhere for the oral argument. And I think that's probably for the best because, you know, obviously my clients don't care if they spend a couple hundred dollars to send me out to Pasadena maybe for a Ninth Circuit oral argument. But certainly there are cases that are smaller that it's not going to be worth it. And if judges have gotten more used to doing this kind of oral argument, then that might increase access to justice and access to oral argument. And it'll just make it easier as I think we transition to you know, vaccine and so forth, so to say that, well, maybe we'll have some arguments in person if everybody happens to be in town, but we can do it also virtually if somebody would have to travel. And as much as I hate this phrase, unfortunately, I think there is going to be a new normal at some point. You know, law firms do have to make revenue, and that you're just going to have to get used to something like this. And that's hard. I mean, I think in the first week or so, I basically shut down and did almost nothing that wasn't on fire because I was overwhelmed. But, you know, once you reach week six or seven, there has to be some kind of routine. And people are going to balance out. And where that balance falls is going to differ for a lot of folks. But I think, unfortunately, there's going to have to be some sort of new rhythm to all of this, because you can't do nothing forever.
So do you think that in-person arguments will probably start back again? I mean, I know, Sean, you're expecting to have an in-person argument at the court, and luckily you're not too far away from the court, but I just wonder, for some of the in-person arguments at the circuit courts, if that's going to be a long ways off in returning, especially if we get a fall resurgence of the virus.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a world in which, you know, the court might say, if everybody's local, fine, come on down. But if you're going to have to travel, maybe not, you know, maybe we'll do it by video or by phone. You know, the Supreme Court, it's easy in that all of them live in the DC metro area, although many of them, have houses or things elsewhere that they tend to work out of or visit out of when they're not actively in session. And a lot of advocates are in, you know, the Supreme Court bar and in the DC area, so maybe they'll come in person. But then again, there are plenty of advocates who have to travel for the Supreme Court, whether it's a state attorney general or just advocates that are, you know, located elsewhere. And it's going to be hard, I think, for them to decide what they want to do. I hope this is a court-led process, because the hardest thing is when they say, well, if you want to have argument on the phone, let us know. Because if you're an attorney who is troubled about traveling or has an underlying medical condition that makes it hard to travel, it's hard to put your hand up and ask for it, because I think all the advocates are going to think, well, I should be there in person, because that way you make the connection in person. And to have to ask for it is going to put a lot of advocates in a lot of very stressful situations, because they'll think they'll be letting their clients down if they ask for it telephonically or video. So I hope that courts come up with rules about maybe, you know, if you would have to fly to come here, we'll do it by video. So that way advocates don't have to put themselves in very difficult positions with clients.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add to that is that I keep track of what the Fifth Circuit is doing on this question pretty closely. And apparently the panels are all splitting on how you do it. So some of the panels have issued statements saying, oh, when the John Minor Wisdom Courthouse reopens, that's the Fifth Circuit's courthouse in New Orleans, we're going to do oral argument in person. And other panels have said, no, we're doing video right now, which is going on this week and has been going pretty well, as far as I understand. And so at least some of the panels seem to think that's going to happen relatively soon. I have serious doubts about that. I mean, you can theoretically drive from Houston to New Orleans. It's 6 hours. It's not a great drive. But if you're an advocate out in El Paso or, you know, Lubbock or somewhere, what are you going to do? Drive 15 hours to oral argument, or, you know, 20 hours? It doesn't seem to make sense to me. And like Sean was saying, maybe if everyone's already in Houston, you can do it. Or maybe if everyone's already in New Orleans. But there's a lot of lawyers in our courts who practice in small towns around the state. It's a big state. So I just don't see how you're going to force them to get on a plane.
If we do move increasingly to virtual court appearance, even only in certain prescribed circumstances where it best promotes access to justice and the safety of all concerned, many on the bench are more than prepared to engage with the technology. For others, though, there will be a learning curve.
Just as an example, I'll take Judge Willett, who used to sit on the Supreme Court of Texas. Of course, he's famous for being the Twitter laureate of Texas. But also, you know, he was on a court that is completely electronic and is doing Zoom arguments and has long televised their arguments. So I'm sure Judge Willett has no problem being on Zoom. And in fact, one of his panels is doing Zoom arguments right now. So there probably is some kind of split among how technically savvy some folks are. I mean, the one difference between the federal courts and the state courts is that the federal judges, of course, have lifetime appointment. And so you've got some judges who are, you know, in their 80s, and, you know, it's totally reasonable that they're not as comfortable as someone in their 40s or 50s with all this technological change.
Do you have any other tips for our viewers or listeners on maintaining your sanity, or, you know, maintaining your practice, or just, you know, getting all your laundry done? That's the current problem in our house. Any great tips to leave our viewers and readers with?
Well, I have a great tip for dealing with the laundry, which is to wear t-shirts all the time. So that is all my that problem. But no, in all seriousness, I think my tip is something Sean and I talked about a couple minutes ago, which is that you've just got to accept that it's not going to be as good as what you normally are doing and as efficient and as fast. And you just say that's okay. And what I have found, I will say, is that my opposing counsel and my co-counsel have all been ridiculously understanding of everything. You know, appellate litigation is usually more civil and there's fewer, you know, personal problems between lawyers. And I found that to be true in this situation. And we've all been working around each other and trying to make it happen. So I think you just got to accept that it's not going to be okay and be understanding of your opponents and co-counsel and partners and associates and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'll just close on saying is, if you have to take it one day at a time, you know, Rafi made the really good comment of turning to his wife and saying, this is hard. You know, I turn to my wife and we say, this was a good day, this was a tough day, and then we're going to go to sleep and we're going to wake up and we're going to do it again. And if you can just try to focus on those little checkpoints during the day, it makes it at least more tolerable. And the other part is, you know, depending where, almost no matter where you are, you're going to have somebody you can call out to for help, be it, you know, I'm at a group of 15, 16, 17 attorneys, and of course, a much larger firm than that. So if I need help, I can get it. And I've had to turn and lean on my associates, on my colleagues, on my partners, and I try to repay that to them when they need it.
As Sean and Rafi noted, the pandemic comes at a time when advances in technology could enable a true revolution in the legal profession, a revolution that could lead to providing better access to justice, better legal representation at lower cost, and working conditions that enhance lawyer well-being and improve the quality of lawyer work product. But technology alone can't make it happen. We need leadership. Leadership from courts and other bodies that make rules governing courts. Leadership that can recognize which processes and procedures still need to happen in person and which are simply antiquated formalities that can be handled by video conference, by phone, or even just on the papers. Leadership from legislatures to give courts the funding to upgrade technology. Leadership from presiding judges to encourage technological competence on the bench. Leadership from those who run law offices, whether they be big firm managing partners or county administrators or others, to support a sustained transition to more hours working from home for both lawyers and staff. Continued leadership from those who regulate the legal profession, including state bars, to hold attorneys to high standards, requiring them to acquire the technological savvy they need to best serve the needs of their clients, and also to continue the increased focus on lawyer well-being. And of course, leadership in legal education to make sure that we are training lawyers ready for this new normal. We'll talk more about that specifically in future episodes. Thank you again to Sean Murata and Rafi Mulconian for sharing their time and thoughts with us. Hungry for more insights on appellate practice? Follow Sean on Twitter at SMMARota and Rafi at RM Fifth Circuit. Or just go ahead and follow hashtag appellate Twitter. You know you want to. And watch more of Tessa's interview with Sean and Rafi. You can find the link on our webpage at law.arizona.edu/legal-writing/practice-in-place. Or on the Appellate Advocacy blog at lawprofessors.typepad.com/appellate_advocacy. Please look for future episodes of Practice in Place on the Arizona Law website and wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope to continue providing a window into how the COVID-19 crisis has impacted our courts and the practice of law, and also to sharing our insights into what the response to the crisis tells us about the past, present, and future of our courts and of the legal profession. Thank you for listening.